Apocalypse or the Sefer Zerubbabel. Martha, thank you so much for coming on the Schwepp to talk about this fascinating time. We have this wonderful work. It's not the only 7th century Jewish apocalypse we have, but it's interesting enough to approach on its own. Maybe other apocalypses will be brought into play during the conversation. But I wonder if you can start out by introducing this work, which you have published recently, a new translation of, not an edition, but you've done editorial work because you had to decide which texts to sort of integrate into your translation, and you've written a study of it. How would you summarize the Sefer Zerubbabel to a complete novice? Because almost all of our listeners, I can guarantee, are going to be complete novices with this text.
I'll try to do that. Let me start by saying, while I think it's you're certainly onto something in calling Sefer Zerubbabel an apocalypse, and I certainly called it that for many years, I actually am not sure it's quite the right term, because I'm not sure that the author, or I probably say authors, were aware of a genre of apocalypse that they could imitate. I think they were more trying to produce a prophecy, and I think they were probably modeling themselves on Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, and maybe the book of Daniel, which we call an apocalypse, but I don't think they would have known to think of it as an apocalypse. So, I mean, it just makes life more complicated to have, I don't know, an apocalyptic work or something, but I think that's not unimportant to keep in mind.
Indeed,
there.
Indeed. So not in a filial lineage with, as far as we can tell, with the mighty corpus of Second Temple apocalyptic, like the Enochic works and etc., but kind of something setting out to chart its own path.
Kind of reinventing pseudepigraphy. I mean, not reinventing it, but, you know, coming up with it again for similar reasons, you know, attributing the work to an important figure of the deep past. So, I mean, it's just interesting to see how those things, you know, can happen without knowledge that someone has done it before you. It must be a kind of natural move in a culture that has a well-established canon. So Sefer Zerubbabel claims to be the revelation, a revelation by the angel who is referred to sometimes as Michael and sometimes as Metatron, a little confusingly, but the chief angel of the future that awaits the people of Israel. The revelation is to Zerubbabel, who is depicted as he is biblically, Persian-appointed governor of Judea at the time of the rebuilding of the temple, of the second temple. And Sefer Zerubbabel will culminate in the appearance of the third temple, so he's kind of an appropriate choice. And the revelation describes to him a kind of complicated eschatological scenario involving three main figures, I think it's of great interest who these figures are. One of them is the Davidic Messiah, I guess, you know, the kind of figure you would expect in a Jewish apocalyptic scenario if you're, you know, thinking of what rabbinic literature has to offer. But his mother, a figure named Hephzibah, also figures in the scenario, and she turns out to be quite a significant warrior. And also a second Messiah, descended from the tribe of Joseph or the tribes of Joseph, who dies in the course of the scenario and has to be brought back to life by the Davidic Messiah, Menachem, son of Amiel. So the scenario, first Hephzibah appears, and she defeats some kings. Then the Messiah, son of Joseph, appears, and Nehemiah ben Hushiel, and he restores the people of Israel to Jerusalem, where they live in peace for some time until the king of Persia arrives and does battle against him. Nehemiah dies in battle, and only then does the Messiah descended from David appear with Elijah accompanying him to bring Nehemiah back to life and defeat the forces of evil, represented now not by the king of Persia, but by Armelos, whose name is probably a reference to Romulus and thus to Rome, the Antichrist figure of this text, who is the son of Satan and the beautiful marble statue of a virgin. So, you know, you can guess at whom this is directed. So the king of Persia sort of, depending on which text of Sefer Zerubbabel you're looking at, he either gets slain or sort of disappears from the scenario. And the ultimate enemy is Armulos, representing Rome, and he is finally defeated too. And at this point, all the dead of Israel are restored. The temple descends from heaven. God himself comes and stands on the Mount of Olives. And, you know, the eschaton has arrived.
Beautiful summary. I want to dive back into that story and pick out some characters and discuss them anon. But before we do that, a bit more due diligence on the text. To avoid going too well, if people want to go pretty deeply into the welter of different manuscripts and editions and stuff that make up this text, they can do so. No better way than to look at the introduction to your book. But let me try to summarize it here, and please tell me if I've missed out that's important. So we'll get to dating in a moment, but we think this text dates to the 7th century. We have some early fragments from the Cairo Geniza, which show that it's very old indeed, at least, you know, pre-High Middle Ages. The largest extant version we have, I think, is the one that's in this high medieval German Jewish anthology, which is a kind of world chronicle that a gentleman in the Rhineland put out in the 14th century, I believe. That is a obviously messed up and corrupt text, or at least a text that's combining a bunch of different shorter texts into one narrative, and you can kind of see the seams between where it's all been stitched together. This is something we're very familiar with the Hechelot literature already, this sort of like, and you know, the Testament of Solomon, works like that, where you can see that an author has just kind of jammed a bunch of stuff together and hasn't done the best job of smoothing out the joins. So far, so good?
Yes, and to further strengthen what you've just said, in addition to that 14th century manuscript, the other kind of full version, if you can call it that, and that's obviously a problematic claim to make, because who knows what was original and what wasn't, is the first edition that was printed early in the 16th century in Constantinople, and that reflects a somewhat slimmer and a little smoother text. And, you know, whether that's more original or, as I think, was an effort to smooth out some of the problems, So it's pretty clear that this is a work that I don't know if it's I suspect not the original authors, but that as it gets transmitted, material gets added to it.
So the point you make in your introduction is just to emphasize what you've just said, or clarify it perhaps. You suspect that the messiness and combination jammed togetherness of this text goes way back. It's not just this 14th century version. It's that even the printed version is probably a picture of an editor recognizing the weirdness of the text and trying to smooth it out before making an edition. Hence things like the angel Metatron also being the angel Michael. Sometimes he's called Michael, sometimes he's called Metatron. Sometimes it says Metatron, who is Michael, which is seems to be an effort to sort out this problem by some editor along the way. So it's a messy, messy text. And we don't have we don't have really much of the early versions of it to try to figure it out.
That's exactly right. We have those Geniza fragments, as you say, but they're already centuries after the presumed date of composition.
Right. Now let's turn to the date of composition. This is very, very interesting. More so than the average question of trying to date a text, because the 7th century has such interesting geopolitical ramification, especially from the Jewish perspective, right? So early in the 7th century, the Persians have kicked the Romans out of the Near East, taken Jerusalem, taken the true cross to Ctesiphon in triumph. Then a few years later, the emperor Heraclius manages to mount a counteroffensive, gets Jerusalem back. The Christians are super chuffed about this. This is the context for the Christian apocalypse of the Pseudo-Methodius, the return of the true cross to Jerusalem and all that good stuff. And then very soon, the whole landscape is going to shift when the Arabs come through and reshape everything. Now, there's been a traditional dating of the apocalypse of the Sefer Zerubbabel, or the Apocalypse of Zerubbabel, that it is a response to the from the perspective of the Jews of Mesopotamia, say, and maybe the Jews of Palestine as well, a response to the liberation of Jerusalem from the yoke of very persecuting Christianity. When it happened, they were like, oh man, Jerusalem is free again. This reminds us of Cyrus coming in and freeing us from the Babylonian captivity, all this kind of thing. Please discuss that dating, the dating of the text in general. How sure are we that this is the context of this work and all this sort of thing?
Yeah, we're not sure. It seems to me that that's the date that makes the most sense of the kind of larger cultural context that I think you can see behind Sefer Zerubbabel. I should say there's a 990-year eschatological timetable that the angel reveals to Zerubbabel, and it's 990 years from the destruction of the temple. So what does that mean? Which temple? So in fact, I think late 19th century scholarship, when it talked about Sefer Zerubbabel, was inclined to place it somewhere, you know, close to the year 1000, because it thought it was 990 years from the destruction of the second temple. I think that's problematic for reasons I'll describe in a moment. Hillel Newman has recently argued that we should think of it as 990 years from the destruction of the first temple, and that, you know, people in antiquity, Jews in antiquity anyway, didn't have a very clear sense of the length of the second temple period. And he thinks we should place Sefer Zerubbabel in the 5th century of this era. So, a bit earlier than I think the kind of, I would say it's now the standard date, in as much as a work that, you know, there's not really a huge corpus of scholarship on it, but you could probably call it the standard date associated with the events that you described. I think probably composed by a Jew in Palestine, and I say that because of his real familiarity with Byzantine Christianity in a way that I think you might not find in Persia. But, you know, to me, one of the crucial point is that this is an eschatologically excited work that doesn't know about the rise of Islam. When you look at Jewish eschatology, eschatological works written after the rise of Islam, they still are pretty focused on Christianity. I mean, somehow, you know, Islam never takes on quite the role in the Jewish apocalyptic imagination that Christianity has had. And we can talk about why that would be. I think there are, you know, some reasons you can imagine for that. Saadia Gaon, writing in 10th or 11th century Baghdad, still thinks that Jerusalem has to be back under Christian control, Roman control, before the Messiah will finally be revealed. But not to know about the rise of Islam, or not to take account of it, sets Sefer Zerubbabel apart from the later series of eschatological works that seem to be drawing on Sefer Zerubbabel, or at least know the outlines of Sefer Zerubbabel's eschatological scenario, and then have to figure out how Islam fits into it. The authors of Sefer Zerubbabel didn't need to know about Islam. So clearly, it predates the fourth decade of the 7th century.
So this is it's an argument from silence, but it is hard to imagine. It's a very loud silence, right? It's hard to imagine someone who's living through the Arab conquests in Syria, Palestine, like the region which got hit hardest and fastest and most, you know, sort of dramatically by the Arab conquest, just ignoring it, just being like, it's insignificant. We don't need to fit that in at all. So early 7th century dating, very likely. You can't really nail it down, but
yes,
it sounds
and I think that the historical events you point to, I think, are, you know, would have been, Christians took them very seriously. You know, it was very shocking to them to have Jerusalem overrun by the Persians. But as you say, for Jews, it was, you know, at least for some, it was clearly, and we have evidence apart from Sefer Zerubbabel for this, we have in Piyutim, for example, liturgical poetry. Isn't this terrific? And the Persians, of course, have a good reputation in biblical history, as liberators. So yes, I mean, it seems to me it does make sense. Now, if Hillel Neumann is right and it should be dated earlier, it would have to shift how I think, for example, about the figure of Hephzibah, the mother of the Davidic Messiah, the models that you can point to in, you know, in developments in Mariology in the 6th and 7th centuries would not be available to explain what's going on. But I think the kind of the larger picture that this needs to be understood in the context of as a Jewish response to Christian rule, I don't think that changes.
Right. One other question I have for you about the text. It's written in an archaizing sort of neo-biblical Hebrew, which doesn't show the phonological change that's what's often called rabbinic Hebrew, but the Hebrew that has been in dialogue with Aramaic for so long that it's kind of taken on some Aramaic characteristics, right? It doesn't have that stuff. So the author is going back to the Ad Fontes, to this sort of biblical style of writing, yeah? What do you make of that, if anything?
Well, I think it's extremely interesting. And one of the things that's very impressive is that it's quite consistently, the copyists resisted what must have been a temptation to slip into that more kind of Aramaizing mode that you describe. And with, you know, one or two exceptions, they managed to, you know, have their plural, masculine plural ending with a mem rather than a nun, you know, which would be the more Aramaic way of doing it. So, yeah, so it is very striking. I think part of it is an effort to present the work as prophecy, you know, but it shows a certain kind of linguistic sensitivity, historical consciousness on the part of the authors that I think is very impressive. You know, you can think about the Dead Sea Scrolls, where the sect chose to write its own works in Hebrew because it's, you know, as if it's identification with biblical Israel. So there may be a bit of that there, but it certainly suggests that the authors were quite learned, you know, learned enough to try to echo biblical Hebrew. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone would mistake Sefer Zerubbabel for biblical Hebrew, but it's an impressive job of sorting out the layers of the Hebrew that they, you know, that they must have experienced.
Right. So they're trying to write they're doing a good job of writing as Zerubbabel would have written this book had it actually been him, this character who...
That's right. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
So, fascinating. There's our text. It's messy, but we can probably locate it in Palestine in the early 7th century. And it tells a future history leading up to the end times, which is always interesting. Now, in the 7th century, one thing I find fascinating is we seem to have a flourishing of divine kings who are going to come back and save everyone. Now, Jewish messianism has been around for a long time, but we haven't talked about it very much on the podcast. And I wonder if you can fill us in on the details of, like, what is a standard, as it were, take on the coming Messiah before the 7th century? I mean, we have these very cryptic hints about a redeemer figure in the Enochic literature. We have things in the Qumran fragments that make us think that there's some kind of, like, redeemer coming. But is there something like a solid doctrinal consensus of any sort about this stuff before this time?
No.
Okay.
It's pretty complicated to try to figure out what expectations were in the Second Temple period. Yeah. You know, I think our vision has been so colored. We have worn the glasses of Christianity to look, you know, to look for things that will help us to understand the earliest followers of Jesus. And, you know, that's quite appropriate. Clearly, they need to be understood in the context of you know, contemporary Judaism. It's just how typical and widespread those sorts of expectations were. It's hard to say. We know from Josephus that the very end of the first century BCE, the first century of this era, there were a number of figures who Josephus wouldn't dignify them by calling them messianic claimants, but figures who either prophesied the coming of the end or presented themselves as new kings. Presumably they claimed some kind of Davidic descent, but you know, we can't tell from Josephus. So, you know, Jesus is not a lonely figure that way. But we don't know much about that. That's at the more popular level. And at the more literary level, it's just very hard to say. The Enochic text that you refer to, attested among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are some hints of a Messiah figure, but not very clear. It's only the Enochic text, not attested among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and therefore more complicated to work with because we don't really have the ancient Jewish certainty that in which a Messiah plays a very important role. I think one thing we can say is, you know, not that, I mean, there was a lot of interest in eschatology. Sometimes the prime eschatological actor, and I mean, you can take this back to the prophets, is God himself. Right. And also angelic figures. I mean, the angel Michael in the book of Daniel in chapter 12, he is, you know, the prince of Israel, and he's going to show up at the end of days. It doesn't seem that there's a human Messiah, that figure like a son of man in Daniel 7, if he is supposed to be a being, is presumably an angelic being, and maybe John Collins has argued, I think, not only compellingly, the angel Michael. So I don't think the Second Temple period gives us a clear view. The Dead Sea Scrolls give us a kind of dual messianism, which might be interesting for Sefer Zerubbabel, but it's not Messiah descended from David, Messiah descended from Joseph. It's Messiah descended from David and Messiah descended from Aaron. And of course, if Messiah means anointed one, kings were anointed and priests were anointed, though, you know, in a very literal sense, right, you would have. So I don't think there's a very clear, widespread Second Temple messianism you can point to.
Right. Well, that is a very clear picture of the status quaestionis, which I think is essential to get our heads around. Because one thing that this book does is lays out a very, very clear might be a wrong way of putting it, but at least you get the impression that the people who wrote the texts that go into the Sefer Zerubbabel had a pretty clear idea of what is going to happen in the future. And it will involve two messiahs, two messianic figures, the Davidic one being the real, the really, really divine one, the really kind of one with like superpowers. I don't mean that disrespectfully. I just mean it as he can do magic stuff, right? He can bring someone back from the dead, for example. Also, he's a suffering figure, right? He's a sort of despised, cast out figure, which is makes us wonder, is that coming from a Christian influence, or did the Christian Messiah come out of an already existing suffering Messiah current within Second Temple Judaism? That's a question for another day, perhaps. But anyway, he's a suffering figure. And you also have this figure, whom you referred to, perhaps incautiously, as an Antichrist figure, Armillos. And these are all, like, it's not sort of like this might happen. This is like, this is what is going to happen. This is prophecy. Do we know anything about a prehistory of this particular architecture of the end times with two messiahs, a baddie, who's this sort of Roman, well, we got to talk about Armillos, he's amazing, but oppressor, devil figure who's half statue, and I should say, a temple descending from the heavens, covering five mountaintops. So like a kind of, the temple is kind of an actor in the eschatology, right? Is any of this stuff identifiable in what has become before?
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I think the answer is yes. And what I mean, I didn't talk about rabbinic eschatology, so let me just say a word there. The eschatology of the rabbis is, in my view, they don't doubt for a minute that the end will come. They don't doubt for a minute that there will be the restoration of a Davidic king, but they really are a little nervous about the whole thing. And we can talk about that maybe for historical reasons, bad experience of the Bar Kokhba revolt, right, maybe for reasons of authority. It's, you know, you won't need them anymore telling you what to do in this new age. They're not that enthusiastic about it, honestly. And they do assume that there will be a Davidic king. But my sense, and you know, certainly I'm, you know, not everyone would agree with this, is that mostly they just would prefer not to talk about it too much.
Right.
Now, I think, you know, our problem is that for most of the rabbinic era, the classical rabbinic era from the end of the first century to the fifth or sixth century, we really don't have much literary evidence apart from what the rabbis wrote. We start having this liturgical poetry, but that's about it. We have some synagogue mosaics. And I've argued that you can use Sefer Zerubbabel to learn something about what popular expectations were during that period. And I say that because there are a number of moments in rabbinic literature where something that shows up in Sefer Zerubbabel shows up, though, in a different way. The suffering Messiah, very much like Menachem ben Amiel, at the gates of Rome, is a famous passage in the Babylonian Talmud about this figure. And he, the rabbi, Joshua ben Levi, encounters him and asks him when he will come. And he says, today. And this, the rabbi is thrilled. And of course, the Messiah doesn't come that day. And when the rabbi encounters the prophet Elijah, he tells him what happened. Elijah is the one who sent him to meet the Messiah in the first place. And Elijah says, you just misunderstood what he said. He was just quoting the psalm, today, if you hearken to my voice. So, of course, he wasn't coming because people weren't hearkening to God's voice. But the point is, you've got a suffering Messiah described using language from Isaiah 53. So your point about the suffering Messiah, look, I think, you know, was Isaiah 53 interpreted in messianic terms before Christians did it? I'm not sure about that one, but the material is there. I think for Jews after Christians do it, to pick it up and do it, is very interesting. The rabbi's approach to Christian messianism seems to me to be avoidance as much as possible, just in a way to pretend it isn't there. The popular response, I think, based on these few moments in rabbinic literature, I take that story about Joshua ben Levi to be a way of undercutting expectations about a suffering Messiah. Sefer Zerubbabel, as you say, makes a suffering, the prime Messiah is a suffering Messiah. Interestingly, he's not the Messiah who dies, right? Maybe it was too much to have the same Messiah suffering and dying. So one gets to suffer and the other has to die. So I think popular expectations in the period before Sefer Zerubbabel probably involved some of the kinds of things we see in Sefer Zerubbabel, but I'm just, you know, trying to get this by reading rabbinic literature against the grain, because that's what we've got.
Yeah. I love that anecdote from the gates of Rome, because it's just classic Talmudic sort of exegetical paradox and embracing it's just weird. Yeah. And we love that. That's fine. It raises more questions than it answers. Throw it in the mix. It's great. Rabbis can argue about it forever from now on. Let's talk about this text if we can. A question I have for you, which I don't expect you to answer now. I don't even necessarily want you to answer it now, but it's a question that I think getting into this text might help to answer, which is, you know, to what degree does this book, which isn't attested very much, but it's clearly, that being said, it's clearly been copied and read by medieval Jews ogogo, because it shows up in the Rhineland in the 14th century and then from there carries on. It's also printed at Constantinople / Istanbul, so it's in the Eastern Mediterranean Jewry as well, in a printed form. To what degree is this book a seminal work for Jewish eschatology more generally? Like, to what degree does this book set some of the kind of characters that will become kind of recognized figures of the end times among Jewry? But don't answer that. It's just, I just want to put that in the air. We have our two messiahs. We've talked about them a little bit. I wonder if you can talk about the character of Metatron / Michael in this work. He's the revealing angel. So with every apocalypse, almost every apocalypse, we expect to find a revealing angel figure. But he's got two names. What do you think is going on here?
I assume that either the earliest form of the work wanted everyone to know, but that by Michael, it meant Metatron. The name Metatron emerges a bit later for the chief angel. And Michael, I think the Prince of Israel is, if there is a chief angel, Michael is the chief angel for in Daniel and that era of Jewish literature. Or he was called Michael in the original work, and somewhere in the course of transmission, someone introduced the name Metatron, though not not as you noted, not as smoothly as might have been done. So I'm not sure. I mean, I guess if I had to have an opinion about it, I would think probably it goes back very early, or else it wouldn't have caused as many problems. If it had been introduced,
right,
by someone later on, maybe it would have been a more consistent mode of combining the two figures. But I don't think there's any doubt in the narrative, in the author's mind, that they are the same angel.
Mm. So Metatron, who comes later to the Jewish tradition, right? Peter Schaeffer has sort of done his best to, who's done all that great work on the Hechelot texts, has done his best to kind of find the origins of Metatron, and it's quite late antique. This is someone who's concerned to sort of, one reading of this double name is this is someone who's concerned to take Michael, who is the chief angel in the biblical stuff going way, way, way back, and just make it clear to the audience that this is the same as this guy Metatron that we talk about now, trying to dovetail the two traditions so that we have a harmony there. We don't have two competing claimants to the chief angel position. That's one possible reading.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's also worth noting that Yakir Paz, who did a study of the appearance of Metatron, argued that Sefer Zerubbabel is the first place you find Metatron as a full-fledged angel, the first datable. Now, I'm a little uncomfortable with that, just because I'm not sure that you can date Metatron. However you date Sefer Zerubbabel, I'm not sure that Metatron can be dated
right
as early as the rest of Sefer Zerubbabel. But it's kind of revealing to to take that into account, that there really are no earlier references,
unless the Hechelot texts go way, way, way back. No one can date these things.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you want to take like Gershom Scholem's reading of the Hechelot text, there.
Yes, I would be very skeptical about that. But yes, I mean, I think you can sort of prove that they're later. But yes.
Okay.
In as much as you can prove anything in the study of that kind of text.
Yeah, yeah. So keen listeners can go check out our episodes on the Hechelot text for more on this. They sort of hover uneasily in the podcast chronology because we just do not know when they're from. And scholarly estimates range over about an 800-year period. So another figure in this text who is extremely interesting, to me anyway, is Armilos, the baddie, the evil king. He is very antichrist-like in the sense that he's going to arise, he's going to charm everyone and sort of take over and be all-powerful, sort of, and then he's going to get defeated, heralding the final victory of God and God's people. He's the son. Well, the accounts of his sort of patrimony, they're not the same every time he appears, but in the most full account we get, he's the son of Satan, his father, and a statue of a virgin. What do you make of that wonderful image?
I mean, I think it's hard to read it as anything other than a swipe at the story of the virgin birth, that the Antichrist is the son of a statue that is surely meant to be a statue of the Virgin Mary. And Satan. So that's it's a pretty not unecumenical way
right.
of relating to their neighbors. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also presumably, assimilating Christianity to idol worship as well, right? The reference to a statue is going to be like these Christians who worship statues.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that I, over the years I've worked on Sefer Zerubbabel, I must say this didn't occur to me early on. But of course, Byzantine Christians did not go in for, you know, in we are in the West are so used to three-dimensional figures of the Virgin. That was not the case in the Byzantine Empire. They mostly restricted themselves to two dimensions.
Right.
That's very clear that that's how Sefer Zerubbabel chooses to represent Christianity. I mean, it's whether, you know, whether that derives from some deep understanding, you know, from a truly held belief, or whether it's simply, you know, a way to punch back at your rulers. I'm not sure which it is, but you know, you can see how a certain kind of very uncharitable Jewish interpretation of Christian reverence for the Virgin could end up describing it as idolatrous worship of a female statue.
Yeah. So this, I guess, leads me to want to ask you a final question to do with the final times, to do with the sort of the Nachleben of this text and also the subject of Jewish eschatology going forward. I don't even know if enough work has been done on this. I'm guessing it probably hasn't. But what contribution does this work make to Jewish eschatology going forward? I mean, and maybe I could preface that question. Like, the reason I find it a vexing and interesting question is when I think of this 14th century Rhineland Jewish dude putting together a compilation of texts to create like a world history, this guy is going to be firmly what we would call rabbinic in his thinking. He's going to know his Talmud. He's going to see Talmud and Mishnah and all of these rabbinic, late antique and later rabbinic texts as Judaism, right? Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, because I'm not a specialist. And then he's going to take the Sefer Zerubbabel, however he knows about it, and find a way to integrate that with this kind of world history. So it can clearly be, even though it is not rabbinic in any recognizable sense itself as a text, it is from the era it arrives in. But as you've pointed out, there's nothing distinctly rabbinic about it, seemingly. It can be folded in to the rabbinic project. But what goes on between the 14th century and the 7th century, or the 7th century and the 14th century? What's the history of this book?
That's a great question. I would start by saying that this guy in the 14th century is very interested in texts that are not rabbinic texts. He includes a lot of, in his World Chronicle, Hebrew translations of Josephus, Hebrew translations of some of the Apocrypha that would have been available to Christians in his world in Latin, may have had, certainly had Greek versions, but may even have had some Hebrew originals, but he's given you a medieval Hebrew version. So he's pretty eclectic in his taste, but I think you're right that he didn't see this as standing in contrast with rabbinic culture. Now, something important happens to the rabbis, that is, they go from being this kind of, I don't want to know if you call them marginal, but this kind of this elite who people may or may not have listened to in the rabbinic era, to their culture ends up becoming the dominant Jewish culture. But to become dominant, it has to also make room for things that it might not have had before. And I mean, I actually think that this is what happens with the eschatological stuff, that as the rabbis gain more popularity, they themselves have to take on more of what people want.
Right.
And, you know, the rabbi, Saadia Gaon, is a great example. You know, Saadia gives you he's a philosopher, you're an extremely elite figure, learned Talmudist, everything else. And yet he gives you an eschatological scenario that if he hadn't read Sefer Zerubbabel, he'd read someone who had read Sefer Zerubbabel.
Got it.
So he needs to, you know, to satisfy the desire for information about what is an important topic for people, what happens at the end of days, he turns to the traditions of Sefer Zerubbabel. And that is, in some ways, to me, you know, I think you're right, there's more work to be done on this, but that is a crucial moment in Sefer Zerubbabel's story, because once you make it into Saadia's Book of Beliefs and Opinions, you know, that's about you know, that's high rabbinic culture of the Middle Ages. So I think that's pretty important. It, you know, it has, Sefer Zerubbabel has a big impact on other works that certainly don't make it into high rabbinic culture, of a whole series of revelations attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So like the Heichalot text, you know, you're taking rabbis as your pseudepigraphic heroes right there. Again, clearly these people either read Sefer Zerubbabel or they read people who read Sefer Zerubbabel. The last moment where I think Sefer Zerubbabel can really be shown to play an important part in Jewish culture is at the time of Shabtai Tzvi. So the great false messiah of the 17th century. I mean, the most important Jewish messiah, you know, since Jesus, clearly.
Yeah.
You know, very important, huge following, big impact. And there was some debate about whether you maybe should understand him as the messiah when his messianic mission failed, at least in the view of most of his, you know, if you were one of his most devoted followers, you had to think that converting to Islam was not what the messiah was supposed to do. His most devoted followers made sense of it, but
yeah,
everybody else struggled with it. Maybe he was the messiah, son of Joseph, and a new messiah. He was preparing things for the messiah, son of David.
Right.
So Sefer Zerubbabel is actually cited a couple of times in the correspondence of Jacob Sasportas, who was an anti-Sabbatian rabbi, in his correspondence with people more sympathetic to Shabtai Tzvi. Sasportas won't have it. You know, he thinks Sefer Zerubbabel is false. But you get it, and even there's a, you know, it's clearly part of the conversation in the 17th century. So that's very significant.
That is significant. If only to help illuminate the absolutely amazing story of Sabbatai Tzvi when we get to it in the podcast, worth the price of admission for that alone. But you've also made a much bigger point, I think, which is that this text from the 7th century, which like no one has heard of outside of a pretty narrow ambit of Jewish studies, actually, and specialists in late antiquity, East Mediterranean late antiquity, kind of no one else has heard about this text. This is really important, right? Even if, and again, I'm going to try to summarize things. Tell me what I'm getting wrong, if I'm getting something wrong. Even if it is a literary representation of popular currents of belief that are not necessarily confined to its pages, but it's kind of a snapshot of what Jews think, or some Jews think about what's going to happen, it seems to set the agenda, or at least be one option for setting the agenda for what's going to happen in the future. What are the end times going to look like? All that stuff among Jews going forward. Like, there's stuff that Jews hundreds of thousands of years, a thousand years later, just about a thousand years later, when speculating about whether this guy is the real Messiah or not, is it happening? Is now the time? Should we all move to Izmir? And, you know, they're, one of the things they're consulting is Sefer Zerubbabel. That's an important text.
Yes. I mean, what I don't know is, were they consulting Sefer Zerubbabel, or did they just know that there was this book, Sefer Zerubbabel, that had, you know, I think in, I mean, it's not pre-printing press, but most of them are living in a pre-printing press world.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure that they were consulting the text, but you're right that the, you know, the text has a reputation that allows people to claim it, to interpret confusing contemporary events.
Mm. Right on. Okay, Martha, what have we not talked about this text that's super interesting that we should talk about?
Well, I guess one of the things I find the most fascinating about it is the figure of Hephzibah, the mother of the Messiah, since mothers of the Messiah really don't figure much in Jewish texts. The rabbis tell a not very nice story about a mother of the Messiah, a mother of a Davidic Messiah whose baby disappears. I think that's probably another rabbinic attempt to undercut what I think probably was popular interest in an idea. You know, Christians had this great idea. The Messiah had a mother and she was really a warm and loving figure. That sounds great. So the rabbis tell a story about how she's a kind of suspect figure, and she tells us that the baby was carried off to heaven, but you sort of aren't really sure. That the rabbis, I think, are, you know, again, trying to undercut something. But what you find in Sefer Zerubbabel is also interesting because it's not a warm and loving mother. It's
no.
a warrior.
She
and
kicks ass.
That, I think, is probably best explained. I mean, Alexei Sivertsev has written about this, I think, very well, that she is modeled, I think people have argued this before, but that the figure of Hefzibah reflects the way the virgin was understood in late 6th, 7th century Byzantine culture. Her icon was taken out into battle sometimes. Mm. And the point Sivertsev makes is the virgin was seen as the protector of Constantinople.
Yes.
She took over from the Roman Trujillo of the city, and she became the patron of Constantinople. Hefzibah is the patron of Jerusalem. She's the one who stands there protecting the gates when the Persians attack, according to Sefer Zerubbabel. So I find this, the appearance of this female figure very interesting. It's also interesting to me that she sort of disappears in the afterlife of the work. I think she probably disappears in the versions of the story told under Muslim rule because she's no longer a figure to match the virgin is no longer so necessary under Muslim rule.
Yeah.
And she also disappears in the West. And I don't, when people pick up bits of Sefer Zerubbabel, I don't know if it's just too uncomfortable. So she does not have a long afterlife.
Yeah. So there was a window in the 7th century when a kick-ass warrior woman who's literally chopping heads and standing in front of the city, protecting it from the onslaught. There was a window when that was an acceptable and cool figure to have in your eschatology. But that window does not go on in Jewish thought.
Yeah, I think there is, as you suggested about the figure of the suffering Messiah, Sefer Zerubbabel has to be understood as responding to things that Christianity offers that rabbinic Judaism doesn't offer. Mm. And it thinks these things are very attractive, but I think also, they're attractive, but they're scary. And, there's a moment where you incorporate them and then some people, the transmission just makes people nervous. So it's a kind of attraction repulsion thing going on, mm-hmm. I think, the larger culture.
Yeah. Martha Himmelfarb, thank you so much for coming on the Schwepp, talking to us about this fascinating text and its place, its context, its future history. Until we meet again, stay esoteric.
Thank you. Your culture.
Yeah. Martha Himmelfarb, thank you so much for coming on the Schwepp, talking to us about this fascinating text and its place, its context, its future history. Until we meet again, stay esoteric.
Thank you.